Hello and welcome to Middle Age Geeks, where we chat about all things geeky, be it movies, TV shows, games, tech, comics, news, and everything in between. I'm one of your hosts, Daz, and with me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Phil. How are you doing, Philly?
I'm doing pretty good, dude. Yeah, it's been a good week. It's caught up with some cool stuff, watching and playing, and I absolutely loved the Oscars. Looking forward to having a chat about that. So the people I wanted to win pretty much won. So yeah, it's been a good week.
Happy days. Yeah, and we are recording on Patrick's Day weekend here. And we're recording a little earlier in the day, so I've had five coffees and absolutely buzzing. Myself and Phil just finished watching Man United beat Liverpool 4-3 in an absolutely cracking match that had it was an emotional roller coaster. So we were buzzing after that. Thankfully, it would have been a different show had we lost. We would have been like, welcome to Middle Age Geeks. Yeah. But we have a great show this week. We will delve into some news. We'll have a brief look back at the Oscars and what we liked and disliked about it, what we've been up to this week, and we have some great feedback to get through as well. And then Phil will take us into a review of Matthew Vaughn's Argyle, and then I'll take us briefly back to an absolute classic video game from 1994, Super Metroid. So first up, on the news front, the Batman Part 2 was delayed. It was announced it was delayed until October 2026, which straight away I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, that's a long, long, that's like 2.5 years away, which is a long time. But then I was trying to compose myself and actually went, first things first, I'm just like, everyone knew it was happening, but I was delighted to hear that it's officially happening. You know, it's officially like it's being done, blah, blah, blah. And hopefully they're going to do the Joker and see where that's going. But what are your thoughts on the delay? And
I'm obviously bummed out because I mean I love the person so much, but like I'm sure that the same care will be put into the second one, and it's going to be well worth the wait. And in the meantime, you know, I think some stage this year we're getting Penguin. We're getting the Penguin series. I think there's rumors that the trailers are going to come out at some stage next week for it.
Oh, brilliant.
That and the June series, that the trailers are going to come out for those next week. So, you know, we'll have that. So at least we'll be getting back into that kind of at least one of the characters. Colin Farrell's incredible portrayal.
Oh, he's fantastic, yeah.
That was brilliant. Such a great imagining of him. I thought he was fantastic. So yeah, no, I'm bummed that it's delayed, but I'd rather it was delayed and we get something great, you know.
Yeah, I'm optimistic about it. Yeah, it's saying that, like, I've never been into the TV shows in the comic book realm per se, bar, you know, WandaVision and a few others, but and I don't know why, really. I just kind of bounce off them. I'm not as interested as the movies, but with the Penguin, when that series was announced, definitely there was a little bit of backlash online. People like going, oh, do we need another TV show? Blah, blah, blah. But straight away, just going Colin Farrell. I'd watch him all day fucking long as that character. Transformative stuff. But yeah, so October. In the meantime, we'll have Superman Legacy or Superman in 2025, so that'll be okay.
Oh yeah, James.
That'll tie us. Yeah. Well, that'll tie us through. Another bit of news this week that we briefly chatted about, that you loved this news apparently, that Patty Jenkins of Wonder Woman 1984 fame is back on directing Star Wars Rogue Squadron. And personally, I'm kind of done with Star Wars to a point, you know, after messing up the sequel trilogy and then continuing down that road with the Rey character and announcing a new movie with her and stuff. It's just kind of like, how much can you just fucking kill this franchise? It's just, they're running out of road. And I know you're a big Star Wars fan, so how do you feel about this being back on? It's good the movie's back on, but the fact that she's attached is a bit of a worry.
I don't like that she's attached. As we said, when people were allowed to kind of, we said about writers, directors allowed to kind of do their thing and not have the studio involvement. You used her very good as an example of Wonder Woman 1984, wrote and directed, and it was poison. And like, even the first one is quite overblown. Like, it's a good movie, but it's not fucking incredible.
It's not the Second Coming.
No, it's not. And I just think, like, Rogue Squadron, you know, it's such a cool, it's such a different story, a little bit away from the main. And I mean, for me, my exposure to it was the, you know, video games and how much crack they were.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just think something a little more, gritty is what I would like from that. You know, something like we got from Gareth Edwards, you know, from my brain is gone now. Rogue One, no. So like I was kind of hoping for something a little bit more like that, whereas I don't think that's the kind of movie we're going to get from Patty Jenkins. So I'm not very happy with her being, I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. But I would, as I said to you, they need to start focusing on quality. Both Star Wars and Marvel need to start looking at some home runs they can hit, because
absolutely,
they're putting out average to poor. And if you look at the stuff like Jon Favreau and stuff has done with the TV series, get him to direct one. Just go look, get him to direct
Give
one.
Give him a movie,
get,
man.
Get something, you'll get something fucking solid. You know, you'll get a solid movie out of it, even if it's not fucking something that's going to shake everything up. But that's what they need right now. And I think that it's a gamble. A big gamble to put Patty Jenkins in charge of this,
and how much control she will have. Like, will some of that be taken back from her after Wonder Woman 1984? Will people kind of go, okay, hold on, no, you can't have final say or final edit on this, and you sure shit ain't writing it.
But she's down as being the writer. You know, that's she's down as being the writer. Sake, that's like, that's the news that came out, not directly. It was her down as writing.
That's my main problem. Like, the writing part, like, I mean, because if she's just directing and someone else is writing, we might get something along the lines of the first Wonder Woman, you know, solid to decent 4-star movie. But we'll see. But next up, the news is the Crow trailer came out. We were only speaking about it, was last week or the week before, but last week the image was released, and it was kind of not so much uproar online, but it definitely divided fan base. So the trailer arrived and you let me know it was online, and I was going to watch it on my phone when I was out, and I said, no, I might as well, I'll give this its time and go back and watch it on my computer. And firstly, I just saw we're already talking about this. Why is it a 3-minute trailer? It's the first thing. It's just like, it doesn't need to be a 3-minute fucking trailer. Like, it's a 2-hour movie. Like, I just, didn't get it. Wasn't a fan of it. The tone seemed off to me, and I know this can be something that is it could just be the way the trailer is edited, the music choices, something like that, but it seems to be missing that poignancy, that grace, the Brandon Lee character, that kind of beautiful melancholy to his vengeful rampage. You know, it's just a perfect marriage between the two. This seemed to be very, very angry, revenge heavy,
emo school shooter vibe is what it gave me. You know, it was just
so violent.
That's what we expected, to be violent, but like, just to what you said and to what we discussed recently about trailers, is like you said, the length, and not only the length, but you're giving away the entire movie. Like, it almost blocks it out. It tells you, it almost gives you his origin at it. You get someone explaining what the character of the Crow is. You see him going, you know, what happens to his missus. The whole fucking movie is laid out in the trailer from start to finish. Like, for fuck's sake, are you doing? Like,
don't need to do this.
You don't need to do that. And this is the first trailer for it. So you could have just, you could have kept it to like a minute long and
give
kept
us
it
a,
dark,
give us a
kept it mysterious.
Moody teaser. Like, give us something to whet the appetite.
Like, people won't, a lot of people who are going to see this movie will never have seen the original Crow because it came out in the 90s. Like, so it's fucking, you know, you're looking at a younger audience will go and see this, who won't have seen the original Crow. So don't fucking spoil it for them to know what the story is with it and all the rest. But just leave them wondering, okay, what story is this character? Mysteriously, why is he fucking supernatural? Why is he this? But no, they just tell you the whole fucking lot in the trailer. It's just, I don't get that. I don't get the marketing behind that at all.
Yeah, it was baffling. It comes across as just the studio being a little bit terrified when they kind of go, we need to show everything, get people on board here. And they think, I'm not sure, I'd love to see metrics on this, whether that actually works, whether if, like, let people know as much as possible about the movie and that will get them to go in and watch the movie. Where sometimes they think like, a teaser's not going to get people to go to a movie, but I would think it would be the opposite. If I see a good teaser, I want to fucking watch a bit more of that. But yeah, there's a nice balance of showing enough of the plot, but don't give away. Like in this trailer, it seems like there's a few shots from really pivotal moments towards the end. You know, some deaths are in there. It's just like, and I only saw it once. It wasn't a rewatch where I picked these things up. But I'll watch it. we'll definitely watch it. I've been waiting for a decent sequel, follow-up, reboot to, or anything Crow related for 30 years, and I've slogged through some of those piss-poor straight-to-video fucking shite in the 90s and early noughties, but...
Fucking Edward Furlong was the Crow.
Yeah, like, come on. Yeah. Like, how the fuck did that happen? Yeah, that we should re-watch one of them. When we do the review of the new Crow, we'll double down and watch. We'll watch all. That's not happening. So yeah, on to some better news or better discussions. The Oscars took place last weekend, and it was initial review on it was I thought it was a thoroughly entertaining show, probably their best show in years. Flew by, paced very well. Obviously, with great wins for Killian, just like, cheery moment. Great to see Chris pick up a directing award, and Oppenheimer, very worthy Oscar winner. I thought Jimmy Kimmel was fine, nothing special, but just did his bit. My favorite moments were obviously Ryan Gosling's music performance, which is the first time I've actually properly watched a music performance and not just tuned out wondering why they're wasting.
Yeah.
Five more minutes, you know, and taking it away from acceptance speeches. But there were great jokes. The I was delighted that Madam Webb got a few shout outs. Derogatory as such.
John Mulaney was great, brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
When he was so like, he was talking about, I thought he was talking about screenwriting, but I watched it back. He's talking about the importance of sound, meaning that like we could sound helps us hear some classic cinematic lines, like we're gonna need a bigger boat, and I'll have what she's having. And he was in the Amazon with my mother while she was researching spiders just before she died. That was just like, oh fucking Ali didn't know why I was pissing myself laughing when we were watching. I said, you need to listen to last week's episode. But I thought it was just really good. And Emma Stone, her acceptance speech, she's just a fucking dote, like an absolute fucking dote.
Yeah, she's great, yeah.
How is she so shocked? You know what I mean? She's just, she's so just raw and just doesn't, she's everything Hollywood is not, you know, in terms of that, acceptance speech. What were your other highlights for yourself?
I loved it. I think Jimmy Kimmel was kind of didn't push stuff far enough for me. I like an Oscars host to be like, I would like to see Ricky Gervais do it. You know, I like to see people getting
absolutely.
You know, but like I thought he was fine. He was grand. I don't have any issue with Kimmel. I thought John Cena's bit was very funny.
He's great.
Coming out in the nip, he was gas. I think he's great as well. Big John Cena fan. Again, I like you. Loved Ryan Gosling's performance. Really, he could, everything he's in is great. All the interviews you see with him, he just seems like a fucking sound dude. So yeah, that was really great. Most of the wins I wasn't totally shocked by. I think most of them were like, okay, yeah, fair enough. The one that stood out for me as a shock was the animated
that
Spider-Man didn't win. Because like when we had our roundup of our stuff of last year,
it's my favorite year movie of the year, yeah,
last year. And I was saying I've watched The Boy and the Heron, and although I think it's great, it's not Studio Ghibli's best work, and I definitely don't think it's as good as Spider-Man by a long shot. I thought that one was a bit of a shock, and I suppose maybe Godzilla might have been come to a shock for some people as well, just because of the money spent on some of these other movies.
That was one of mine on the Godzilla one. Like I've seen Godzilla Minus One, but I only saw it on a screener. DVD, so it wasn't like excellent quality, but like it can't have looked better than the creator, right? The creator was just, as much as we picked it apart a little bit episode one way back when, but even just looking back at some of that footage, it's a phenomenal looking film for the budget. It's astonishing. What was your take on that? Like, you've seen the two properly in cinemas.
I loved Godzilla. And like I'm, as I said, we both enjoyed Creator. It's just that it wasn't didn't live up to what we thought it would be. But both were gushing about how amazing looking it was. And I was surprised. That would have been my pick. But like Godzilla still does look great, and what they were able to do, like their mixture of practical effects, real effects, but just from a visual effects standpoint, I would have preferred to see. I would have picked a creator, but at the same time, the excitement, like those, they were just in the absolute buzzers. The guys from Godzilla, like they all had their shoes. They all had their shoes.
And the little Godzilla
claws
things
and stuff. And the little Godzilla statues, and they were just, they were just over to have fucking banter, like, and so they were. You wouldn't begrudge them the win, but I just thought that those two were the ones that stood out for me. Whereas the rest, you were kind of like, Robert Downey Jr. was incredible, well deserved his award. Everyone was great. You won, I forget her name, Divine or Devine, I can't remember her surname, who won Best Supporting. She in Holdover is fantastic. So they were all. I was happy with the winners. Obviously, especially Cillian Murphy.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think a few things that didn't go so well, like some of the presenting things just didn't kind of hit. And I always find it funny that you have these actors coming out just to present, you know, a line or two, and you see actors unable to act on stage.
Kind of get
it wrong. Melissa McCarthy and stuff, and just, get it kind of wrong. But Al Pacino, like, doing his best drunk uncle at a wedding. whose idea was it to give him that and to deliver the, you know, best picture final prestigious award in that manner? It was baffling. It's just like, what is happening here? It felt so flat.
He was awake on the couch. It's like he was asleep on the couch and someone just woke him up out back. It's Al, you're on. And he just fucking, threw an envelope and he fucking stumbles out like fucking Oppenheimer. He looked out of it.
Absolutely.
It was a bizarre choice. I agree with that. My other gripe just always would be, firstly, Lance Reddick wasn't on the fucking In Memoriam thing. And then the other one was, I didn't care for the five previous winners.
That's my main fucking thing. Like, it's hit and miss with them, because they come out and five winners come out, and it's they do this every kind of 5 or 10 years. They're gonna go, oh yeah, instead of showing clips from the actual movies, the previous winners come out and they each talk about a specific person. But some of them work, like Sam Rockwell talking about Robert Downey Jr. They obviously have a connection, they know each other, they've worked together, and it's very kind of it's slightly scripted, but it's definitely there's a bit of connection, a bit of ad-libbing going on there. And then you have, like, you know, Brendan Fraser or something just delivering something and just reading from a teleprompter and just talking about, you know, Bradley Cooper, and you can just, it's just like they've never fucking met each other in their life. It's just like, yeah, your work is so astonishing, and it's just like, and the reaction of them is like, oh, thanks so much, and it's just so, there's nothing there. It's just like they need to fine-tune that, because it works and then it doesn't work.
That was one of my
big gripes. It takes too long. But in terms of the In Memoriam, fuck me sideways. It was just like they're cutting to a wide shot of like dancers going around and whatever. I know it's nice that somebody delivers a lovely song or whatever, and it's fine to have people on stage doing that. But what the fuck are the dancers going around? They're not showing. I couldn't see the names of the people who had fucking died, let alone what their job was. I'm just like, what are you doing? Just play the fucking song, cut to the guy singing, and then just cut to the screen and just give these people who've passed away their fucking moment. Just like, oh, let's cut to the sweeping white shot. These fucking stupid dancers. That drove me fucking insane. It's overproduced. It's overthought. It's just like, fuck off, man. That wrecked my head. But all in all, thoroughly enjoyable evening and well worth staying up for, I think. So let's get on to what we've been playing and watching this week. What have you been up to?
Playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Now I've only started, when I played a few hours of it, so I'm still like in Nibelheim. I only just started.
Yeah.
But God, it's just a gorgeous looking game. You know, it's just fucking beautiful. Like that, it's straight away, the music, everything kicks in, and just straight away felt like, oh yeah, this is it. Like, cause I was humming and hawing about playing it, because it's such a commitment to get back into games of that size. It's like, oh
yeah, yeah.
Do I really want to start? I'll just download it. But once the music kicked in from the start, like, yeah, that's it. I'll definitely be getting this finished. So, I've had to do a good bit of running around the past few days, and so I haven't gotten to get stuck in. But I'm hoping to during the week I'll get cracking into it again. With regards to watching, so there's one thing we talked about before, and we didn't get to go and see it in the cinema, which was Sisu. So I finally got around to watch it, and it's about, you know, the he's like, it's basically a one guy fighting a bunch of Nazis. A guy in Finland, and he's like,
the trailer looked fucking insane.
Ex-Marine. He says, and I, this is no joke, he says two lines in the entire movie and the last two lines of the movie. That's it. It's incredible. That's brilliant. Say anything in the whole movie. But he's just this fucking badass. And it's just some of the death scenes. But who doesn't love seeing Nazis getting killed? Like there's I won't ruin the whole thing, but there's one great thing where he's hiding from them. He's underwater and he's hiding from them, and they're after him to get what he has. And so he's out in the kind of river, and they send out these Nazis in the boat. They go, go down and get him, go down and get him. So this guy fucking swims down. While he's under there, our protagonist slits your man's throat, right? Puts his mouth up and breathes the air out of your man's lungs so he can stay under there longer. It's fucking awesome.
That's the best thing I've ever heard in my life.
It's fucking awesome. But there's just loads of really cool death scenes. Loads of laugh out loud. So like fucking cool. Shocking death scenes. It's a lot of fun, very gory, you know, it's good crap. So I definitely recommend that one. And then the only thing I watched, I started watching The Last Airbender, the live action.
Oh yeah, is it any use?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. Like, I think I'm not sure if I never watched much of the original animated series. Some friends
saw the fucking movie, the Shyamalan movie.
I saw, my Shyamalan thing, disaster, but I decided, no, I'd watch this. So I'm three episodes in, and I'm enjoying it. I like the little kid who plays the main character, is Aang. He's really good. The visual effects are pretty good. Like, I'm enjoying it. But, that's about it for myself. What about you?
Played a few things actually this week, mainly because of trying to see what games look like, how they look like on the PlayStation Portal, you know, if I'm up in my bed playing. So I delved back into Cyberpunk, into the DLC, finally played the DLC after downloading it and never played it the first time. And it's fantastic. Yeah, it's the new area that opens up, Dogtown. That map is amazing. It's like this crumbling part of the city that's showing signs of like destructive warfare. It's just been in fucking bits, and finally met Idris Elba's in the game. But that's just cool. And he's just modeled exactly like Idris Elba. It's not just the character look, but the plot is intriguing. It's opening up a bit. Just absolutely loving that. So that's been my main thing at the moment. I also got stuck into Rollerdrome. This fucking crazy rollerblading game. But let me go on. It's a rollerblading futuristic arena kind of game, like a mix between Tony Hawk's Skateboarder and Schwarzenegger's The Running Man. But with rollerblades.
Oh, so it's violent.
Yeah, it's fucking super violent. But you're like, you fly around in futuristic skate arena with like twin pistols in your hand, and give core game mechanics, you have to do tricks to fill up your weapon or your weapons with ammo. Of course you have a slow-mo meter. So like when you put that all together, you have like epic jumps and tricks and slow-mo backflips while fucking pumping dudes full of lead and dodging missiles. And it's, you know, like Tony Hawk back in the day, when you enter that kind of flow state and you start getting all the buttons together and pulling off some of this crazy shit. It's mesmeric. Like, and it's my new kind of pick up and play. Just 20 minutes here and there, just kind of go, play one arena game or whatever. But it's quite difficult, but it's really good. Next one I've been playing is the least geeky game I think you could ever play, is like the snooker world champions are coming up, world championships. So that I always get stuck back into snooker on the PlayStation, which baffles my wife completely as she walks by. Just like, are you watching that or playing it? It's my go-to game for some chilled, focused evenings. Last night I made a break of 140, 7 off a maximum break, and that will mean absolutely nothing to almost everyone listening. But to me, it was the highlight of my week. That's everything on a gaming front. Just kind of been flipping between different games. Watching-wise, apart from the movie we're going to review, I've been watching more of Shogun, the Japanese... medieval, but set in the 1600s. It's fucking fantastic show. I'm in episode 3 now. It's amazing. The world building in this is on par with some of the most epic big budget movies you'll ever see. Like, the cast are sensational. Sanada is one of the most watchable actors on the fucking planet. Like, he's just he's unbelievable. I could just watch him just drink fucking tea for hours, just let alone chop off people's fucking heads. But yeah, he's it's just fucking brilliant. Really, really, really good show. Anyone wants to fucking get into a new show, get on that. It's brilliant. So yeah, just before we get into the review, I might touch on a little bit of feedback we got. So Lego Tape got in touch on social media to ask about our thoughts on the Halo series. Now, I watched a few episodes of the first season and didn't really grab me at all. And as I was saying, maybe I'm not that kind of invested into the Halo games, or, you know, the TV series based on, you know, games or movies. I'm not really into that as much, but I fell off that show pretty quickly. But I do hear that the series two is getting some really good reviews, which always poses that problem that, can you jump into series two, or do you have to go back and wade through kind of maybe a substandard season? Have you watched it at all? Or
no, I haven't watched it, but I was gassed. I was only reading something online about it the other day, and there was people bitching and moaning about it. And I saw someone say on Reddit, they were saying it's a prime example of people who haven't played the game or something, or, you know, who've made it. But I was thinking, like, I played the Halo games, but I couldn't tell you the fucking story from the games. I know, like, Master Commander is the name of the main character.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, I play those games to blow up fucking aliens, and, you know, Mildred, I don't really pay any attention to the fucking plot whatsoever. So
me neither.
I don't think it really matters. I think this is a prime thing where you could go and do whatever the fuck you want with it, because the stories for these games are so thin. And, you know, I don't know, maybe some people put a lot more stock in the story for those games than I do, but I would have thought this was something you could easily do your own thing with. Now, I haven't watched it. I've loved the look of some of the stuff that I have seen.
It looks great, yeah.
No, I haven't gotten around to it. I'll probably do a binge watch of it at some point.
Or just do a recap of season one and get stuck into season two or something like that. But yeah, it's definitely, the season two is on the radar anyway. Might, maybe binge it at some point. Next up was Simon emailed us in to ask us about E3. Comic-Con asked if we'd ever been to E3 or San Diego Comic-Con, because he was just lamenting the fact that E3 has gone by the wayside and has been indefinitely cancelled. For anyone listening who doesn't know, E3 is like a video game showcase event that used to be the pinnacle of the video game calendar. And myself and Phil have been planning to go for that fucking decades. And
we were trying to think of ways to get us, like, how could we get ourselves press passes? How could we get ourselves in there in some way? But there's no way we were ever going to get invited. Like, we were planning this back when we were like 20 something years ago. How could we get to this thing?
Two decades on, we still didn't figure out how to get there. But we did. I remember we were in the queue for San Diego Comic-Con tickets one year, and it was such a weird way of trying to get tickets, and it just kept timing out. And it's just like, what the fuck's going on here? So unfortunately, we didn't get to go to that. But I think that aspect of these showcase events is falling by the wayside completely. I mean, like, San Diego Comic-Con used to be the mecca of like TV show reveals, movie trailers. You'd hear about a movie trailer that has been released in Comic-Con and you'd never see it for 6 months. Where, you know, only a few years ago, when even when Batman versus Superman, when that trailer played at Comic-Con, it was released straight away online at the same time. And it just kind of went, well, what's the point of actually going just to see the actors on stage, unless you're from the general vicinity? Like, we would be paying fucking thousands to go to this thing. So, yeah, I think we may have missed the boat with that one. But we are going to London Comic-Con in July, where we will be attempting some live streaming or some shit like that for the crack. Just to look like dorks walking around with cameras and phones, and we'll have our t-shirts and merch and all this shit, so that'll be a bit of crack.
Look like lunatics. Yeah, that'll be good fun just to kind of go to one outside of Dublin.
Absolutely.
There's one in May, which I think everybody would make the one in May, and then there's another one in July, so we're going to the July one. So any of you people are going as well, we'll see you there.
Absolutely. So yeah, that wraps up some of the feedback and some of the early parts of the show. So now let's get stuck into Matthew Vaughan's Argyle with Phil. And we've discussed this with regard to one aspect of the movie, the music, and we actually haven't chatted at all about this movie. So it's always interesting to get stuck into something that way. So take it away, Philly.
Cheers, dude. Yeah, this is. I'll give you the synopsis first, and Daz, I'd like to hear your initial thoughts. So, this, as Daz said, is directed by Matthew Vaughn, and the kind of synopsis is that there's a reclusive author who writes espionage novels about a secret agent and global spy syndicate, realizes the plot of the new book she's writing starts to mirror real world events in real time. So, directed by Matthew Vaughn, written by Jason Fuchs, and the stars. Bryce Dallas Howard, Sam Rockwell, Henry Cavill, Samuel L. Jackson. We'll get on all that into all that as we go through it. But what were your kind of initial thoughts on it, Daz, knowing what we kind of know about Vaughn's work in the past?
Yeah, I was I had seen the fact that it was getting not so great reviews online. We'd seen that beforehand, but watching it went to, because I love Matthew Vaughn's stuff. Love his stuff. Not the kind of later Kingsman stuff as much. And that's where this movie, I think, is following that path, which is a strange path. And I don't know if it ties into that kind of too much control or something like that, or just, I don't know. But this film, I think, my first thoughts were it really showcases that extremely thin line between creating a movie like The Kingsman or Kick-Ass, which have a heightened sense of reality and exist, you know, in a world that... that is grounded but unbelievable, but can still have fantastical elements in it. And creating a movie like this, which tries to kind of traverse that similar fine line, but falls ever so slightly into the realm of slapstick and nonsense, and then kind of becomes a bit silly and daft. And that's where I think this movie is. It just misses a mark tonally ever so slightly, but by doing so, I think it falls off a cliff into like buffoonery, and just I just couldn't really give a shit about anything that was happening. And there are very questionable choices in terms of the visuals. I don't understand why there's so much CGI in this movie. We'll obviously get into that. I know it was filmed around pandemic times, and I think it was maybe difficult filming circumstances, but there's no reason for it to look as bad as it does. Everything just seemed a bit so silly, and there's no stakes whatsoever, and just seemed very convoluted. And we'll get into the music, but I was 30 minutes in, I felt bored is a strong word, but just I just couldn't get engaged into it. And I don't know if I was it took me three times to watch it. I don't know if I was tired or something like that. I'm always open to that aspect of what state you're in watching a movie. You know, if you're tired, you might not be engaged as much as possible. But the start of this movie just didn't really get me. It kind of started too fast in terms of stuff like The Kingsman, where Kingsman was a bit more slick and a bit more fucking confident and punchy, where this just kind of starts at 100 miles an hour and you're kind of struggling to catch up. So yeah, I didn't really like it. No, didn't really like it. How about yourself?
Yeah, similar thoughts. I mean, I was looking forward to this because I was hoping it'd be a return to form. Okay, The Kingsman and Kingsman Golden Circle, I did think were great. They were his last two movies. But before that, he'd done Kingsman and you'd done X-Men First Class, you'd done Kick-Ass, Layer Cake.
Layer Cake's probably one of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, I think Stardust isn't a bad movie either. It's a bit of fun, fantasy kind of stuff. But to go the three in a row, to go from Kick-Ass, X-Men First Class, Kingsman, that these were all in the space of 4 years, three really good movies.
Yeah, wow, 4 years.
But then, but I just think that he's kind of gone downhill. He did the two sequels, and they weren't great. They were okay. But for me, I think this is his worst work. I was looking forward to it because I find his stuff, even when it doesn't hit home, still looks and feels super slick. I don't know. This felt like it was trying to be sort of slick, but not actually hitting any of those marks. We'll get into it. I'll go through, we don't have to go into a fucking insane amount of detail, but I'll kind of go into just how it is. It's kind of difficult to go into a massive amount of detail because of the twists and the attempted twists. The stuff that I'm going to be talking about at the start, is going to make massive sense as I go on, But it opens up basically with Henry Cavill as Argyle, who, for me, for some reason, I know this is a weird thing to say, I didn't think Henry Cavill looked great This was something just didn't look the weird hairdo they gave him. And
that's my first note. My first note is flat top. Why the fuck does he have a flat top? And he looks kind of uncomfortable or something weird. Yeah,
it was a strange choice. Like, so he kind of opens up and it's him at this scene with Dua Lipa, and like it's a whole thing. It's supposed to be real James Bond esque. He's kind of getting her they're doing a dance sequence, and then, you know, all of a sudden her fucking bad guys come in, whatever else. But she ends up escaping. She's the bad guy. She ends up escaping. And it's just the escape scene. If we talk about those effects you mentioned, Daz, the escape scene, the CGI is absolutely
so
terrible.
Bad, right?
Like
and that's the introduction to the movie's visual kind of palette. Like, and it's just...
Yeah, that's it. Like, she's escaping on a motorbike, but she pulls out a machine gun first and she shoots this Jeep he's about to jump into, killing his partner, Kira, I think her name is, killing her, and she takes off, and it's this overhead shot of her tearing away in the motorbike, and you're looking at it going, that looks like something off an advert. It looks so, so bad, and then he's chasing
from 2000,
the Jeep thing, and he's chasing after it. It's crashing and sliding down walls, and it's just, it looks so bad. I'm like, fuck, man, the movie's just after starting, like, and this cost the same amount as Dune. This cost $200 million.
Yeah.
So when you look, we talked last week about how well Dune's budget was spent, and then the creator. What was the budget of creator? 80 million,
like 60 or 80 million, yeah, astonishing,
yeah, like,
right?
No, and then this is $200 million, and to look the way it does is just it's not great. Anyway, besides the terrible effects, I mean, how did you feel about the setup? What direction did you think it was going at this point?
It just, yeah, like I understand the way, like, it starts with this kind of, I keep using the word slapstick, but this kind of hyper real, take on this world with the spy genre and blah, blah, blah. Like, we're talking like the Kingsman, like they can do kind of crazy things and crazy action, just things, you know, like a Henry Cavill driving that fucking Jeep down, and it's all great, but it just, A, it looks bad. B, just like the kind of physical actions just look poor. It looks like it's, like there's bits where she's grabbed off the bike by John Cena and stuff like that, which we'll get to later on. But yeah, moments like that where you're just, it's like, is this in the King, because this is technically in the Kingsman universe, what they say. Is this Kingsman universe, or is this like Hot Shots Part 2 or something? You know, it's just like, and I know we'll get to kind of the reveal of this introductory section, and but even you're kind of hoping then that you're kind of going, oh, this is supposed to be this silly because, you know, there's, you know, it's her, it's part of her book or whatever, but it continues down that path for the whole thing. This uneasy feeling of like, this is just not polished. It's all a bit kind of haphazard and doesn't look good. It's just not very tight in terms of just the feel of the movie. I was definitely unnerved by everything about it at the start.
I agree. It's here we kind of, as you said, it's here she's escaped from the bike, but she gets past John Cena is there. He grabs her off the bike as it's going past at like 100 miles an hour. He reaches over.
Yeah, just silly, like.
They sit down to have coffee, John Cena, Henry Cavill, and Dua Lipa, and we find here she finds out that they work for the same boss or whatever like that. Finds it horrible. His Henry Cavill's boss had tipped off Dua Lipa, and so she ends up pulling out some sort of poison, and she kills herself. And then it cuts to the story being written. We cut to read by Bryce Dallas Howard at a book signing. And she's the author, and she's reading out the scene we've just seen. So she's right. The whole thing is that she's, as I said in the synopsis, she's a spy novel writer, and this main character, Argon. And so that's we get to, oh, okay, that makes sense. This whole opening part is just thing. Is this going to happen? And that's the thing that bothered me. We find out that she lives alone, and just her and her cat. And we see her, and she's trying to... She's writing the book, the next book, as she goes along, and it jumps then into the scene that she's writing with Cavill. And I don't like those scenes where she's kind of, she's telling him what to say, but she's having kind of writer's block. you know, as she's doing it, and it's cutting into them while she's writing, and they're acting out what she's saying. And there's too much. They're trying to do that throughout the movie, where they're jumping from what's real, what's not, what's the book, what's not, and it's not done well enough. It's jarring. I'm not a fan of those type of scenes myself.
My main problem with that kind of stuff, I think we'll get to it later in the train sequence, whereas is this like the extreme point of view shots that Matthew Vaughn obviously thinks is fucking killer, like you see her blinking, and every time she blinks, you know, things change, you know, reality kind of changes or whatever in her head. But that just was fucking mind-numbingly excruciating to watch. It just annoyed me more and more. It annoyed me the second time they started doing this kind of stuff. And it was even more annoying the fucking 227th time they did this kind of stuff. It's just too much. You know, it's just overly convoluted. Not even to get into the plot, how convoluted that is, but visually it's just as... It's like kind of like, oh, look, here's a cool thing. Oh, here's a cool thing. What if I do it? I'm going to show this another cool way. And it's just like, fuck it, just slow down a second. Slow down a second. Let's get our fucking bearings here.
Yeah, no, agreed. And like, we start getting into that just almost directly after this scene. So she's struggling to finish. She says she's finished the ending. She sends it to her mother. Her mother reads it and calls her and says she's not happy with the ending. Her mother is played by the wonderful Catherine O'Hara. So she tries to ride it, but she hits writer's block. So she goes, "No, well, I'm going to get." She doesn't fly. So she says, "I'm going to get." She's going to get a train to go and see her mother. So while she's sitting on the train, Sam Rockwell comes down and sits opposite her. Now, Sam Rockwell is supremely watchable in pretty much anything, and this is no different. He's doing his best at what he's given in this. You know, he's
the best thing in it by a mile.
He is. Yeah, he's still really fucking slick, and he delivers his lines really well. But he meets her on the train, sits down across from her, and he starts telling her that, you know, he almost tells her almost straight away, first of all, I'm a fan of your book, but then he tells her he's a spy. And a whole fight breaks out because while she's on there, he tells her he's a spy, he tells her that some of her books and stuff are coming through. This next thing, this fight breaks out because there's a bunch of people on the train that are trying to kill her. So
about 40 of them, right? They just keep coming.
Yeah, they just keep coming. They're all over the train. Some of them are sitting around. Some of them are coming from different carriages. Like, they're coming from all over the place. Like, it's mental. Like, if they didn't know he was going to be there, how many people did they need to kill this one rider? But anyway, there appeared to be where she's having this fight. As you said, this is when she starts having the hallucinating. She starts seeing Sam Rockwell as Henry Cavill. So she's blinking and she starts shaking her head. And then Henry Cavill is kind of looking and winking back at her. So she's smiling and happy to see Henry Cavill as if he's kind of flirting with her, but then she's kind of terrified of Sam Rockwell as this guy who's battering people on the train. And like, it's like, there's nothing wrong so much really at the choreography of the fight scene so much as just the fact that we keep cutting to her, she blinks, and we're cutting, oh, it's Henry Cavill fighting. No, actually, it's Sam Rockwell fighting. Yeah. No, actually, it's Henry Cavill fighting. No, it's Sam Rockwell. And he keeps doing this back and forth. It's like, just fuck off. If you want to have it, change the whole thing. Say she blinks and the whole aesthetic, say, changes. You know, like in like Kill Bill, when she's fighting all the crazy 88, at one point she blinks, and when she blinks, everything turns black and white, and the fight continues in black and white. It cuts through again, she blinks, and we're all back in color again. Do something like that, you know, blink, and it gets into a real surrealistic, you know, super bright world like that you would see in from the books that she's writing. Do something like that. The only thing that changes is that there's a transposition between Henry Cavill and Sam Rockwell, and it doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work at all. And it must have taken them fucking ages to stage the exact same sequences with both actors for days, weeks. It's a very elaborate thing. And they do this thing, they kind of not even double down, they triple down on this thing where like it cuts to Sam Rockwell and he's the kind of, he looks at her, he goes, you know, everything's going to be okay. And you know, someone tackles him or kicked in the face or whatever. But they do this so many times and it's like, we get it. He's a bit lax. He's a bit over chilled out for a spy, but you don't need to keep showing us this. There's four or five times to just punctuate this joke. And it's like, we fucking get it. And then it's back to Henry Cavill. And it's just, it was like being kicked in the fucking head watching that movie. Luckily, I didn't see it in the cinema because we'd be front row and our eyes would be bleeding. Yeah.
I was looking forward to seeing it in the cinema. I didn't fucking waste my time. Anyway, look, They end up escaping off the train. He has a parachute in his backpack, so he grabs her, pulls the cord, and they fucking fly up the back of the train. And she passes out from the fucking sheer shock of everything that just happened. Wakes up.
Is that some of the worst CGI you've ever seen in your life?
The eyes closing as they get, first of all, the CGI, but then the eyes closing like this, her getting knocked out, is just fucking stupid as well. It looks awful. But she wakes up in this log cabin, and Sam Rockwell, he explains about the people that are after her. He says that the books that she's writing, that they're predicting the future pretty much. Like when she's writing stuff that she's been writing about, the stories, he's like, that actually happened to me. You know, this has already happened to me. He goes, so you're able to write stuff that you're putting in these books actually happens. And he said there's an organization called the Division that are looking to get you because of it. And he said, these are the people that were on the thing, and they're going to keep trying to hunt you. He says, I can help you, but I need you to help me first. He said, what you're writing about Argyle is actually what happened to me. And I'm trying to get my hands on this master file that can take down the Division that's led by Brian Cranston. And he's like, if you help me do this, well then, you know, I can keep you safe and help you. So she agrees to help. We get Brian Cranston in his kind of lair. And it's just, he's so cartoonish. You know, it's like what they did with, what he did with Samuel L. Jackson in the first Kingsman movie. You know, he's just so evil bad guy kind of thing. And it's
one
just,
note, yeah.
And he's not as interested. Like the cool thing with Samuel L. Jackson in the first one was he kind of had the lisp and he was the bad guy who hated the sight of blood. He got freaked out by it.
There's something really quirky to him.
You know, whereas Bryan Cranston just seen it's a mustache twirling bad guy. It's a waste of Bryan Cranston, to be honest. But she ends up saying that she says something along the lines of, she was planning on having it go to London, or the next part of her book was going to go to London. That's where we should start next. I can't what the line is, but she's very easily convinced to go to London with him. And so they fly on he's able to get a private jet, and they fly to London, and he needs her to write then the next chapter because he knows there's a hacker he's supposed to meet. The hacker doesn't show up, and he needs to meet up with this hacker to get this file. And so he's like, I need you to write the next chapter. So did you find how quickly she got on board with this? Like, he's talking about predicting the future, and she's like, okay, well, I'll get my laptop out, I'll write this in the chapter. And when she starts writing, he's like, no, that can't happen because of this. Oh, well, I'll just come up with this other idea. She's like, have you got the burner phone? We can pretend that. And then she has a flash to a scene where John Cena and Henry Cavill are sitting there, and they find this thing in the phone. And he goes, no, I threw away the burner phone. Oh, well, now I have to write something else then. You know, and it's just...
That just confused me when I was watching it. Just like, why is this happening so quickly? And she was so against it. And now it's just like, oh my God. Yeah, I was highly confused.
Is she not like, so if I'm writing this, is this going to come true? Is that what you're saying? Like, she doesn't seem to be saying any of that. She's just like, okay, well, let me write for God's sake. And she's just...
She goes along with this crazy premise.
So she writes, she's like, okay, well, what about this? And then if you found this, this would lead us to this satellite. And then, wait a minute, this satellite leads us to this. So she's so, it's so fucking, she's like, how she's not completely shocked by the fact that this stuff is coming true.
Yeah.
You know I mean, that the stuff she's...
And how she knows this stuff and all that. Yeah. She's asking all the wrong questions.
Which is frustrating as the viewer. So they end up that the it leads them to this apartment where they find some clues, and it belongs to the hacker of the apartment, and they find this logbook that belonged to him.
Mm.
But again, you know, all of this, like, he's ready to leave the room. She's like, no, look, these things all link up. Completely on board with the whole controlling reality thing. So quickly, like, she's on board with it. Okay. So they end up hiding under the floorboards in the place because the bad guys show up. And they're hiding, but the cat that she has with her, this cat she's obsessed with, Alfie, ends up sneezing or meowing or whatever the fuck. And so the bad guys realize they're in the floor. So Sam Rockwell has to jump up out of the floor and take out all these bad guys. And this here is one of the first instances of what me and Daz were saying or discussed. The only message we had back and forth was, Jesus, the music in this thing doesn't work. And it's because they throw in a disco tune. And I like fucking disco, you know what I mean? But they throw in disco tunes over the fight scenes and they just don't work. Like, there's one on the train scene, but you're thinking, okay, well, it's only the first really fight with Sam Rockwell in it and stuff. Maybe it's just one. But then it happens again. We've got another fight, and it's another disco tune that isn't fitting with the fight scenes at all. Like, it's not working at all. And this is a theme then throughout the fucking movie. We'll come to another awful one later on, but this happens. You keep doing this for the fight scenes. Like, you found this as perplexing as I did, Daz.
Oh, yeah. I don't understand and will never understand how the wrong music choices were made in this movie, and how Vaughn has gotten that movie trope so wrong. That generally works when people know what they're doing. You know, when you take an action set piece and you can play it with like a lovely romantic ballad or whatever. If you get it right, the juxtaposition, the fucking polar opposites of the two just come together in something, and it just works fucking brilliantly. There's nothing better than hearing some lovely piece of kind of soft music with absolute slow-mo carnage or something in the background. John Woo did it fucking great. Like, loads of directors have fucking killed it. But the fact that in the editing room, Vaughn literally sitting down going, yeah, that's the fucking track. We fucking nailed it. Like, this one's bad. There's just a lot of other ones. Like, the one we'll get to later on is one of the worst moments or examples of this wrong music later on, actually. The fact that, yeah, we'll talk about that later on, but that is,
yeah,
it just takes you completely out of the movie. It's not something where, like, the choreography and stuff and can be all fucking great or over the top, whatever, but you're just, something just fucking, it's like something flicking you in the back of the ear while you're trying to watch it. You know, just like, this music is awful. It's like, and it's not that the music may be fucking bad, it just doesn't work with the scene. It's wrong. It's like, should it be in slow motion? Should it be a softer song? Should it be something? It just showed how you can get it so wrong after seeing it get it. So many directors get it so right. And it's always just like, that's so cool. And you just must think that it's just easy. Take an action scene, find a banging tune, disco tune, whatever, marry the two. But this just showcases it's fucking not easy. And when it goes wrong, it really goes wrong. And an actor or a director of his caliber sitting in the edit room just going, I've nailed it. It's just like, whoa, man, you really didn't. You really didn't. Like, it's really bad. Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit, okay, this is 10 times worse than it, but it reminded me a little bit of Watchmen by Zack Snyder, which I really like that movie. Yeah. I love it, actually. But there's incredible music in that that's put in just the scenes where it didn't work. Like, all along the Watchtower is played towards the end. And one scene, it's like, that's just forced on top of that. There's a Jeff Buckley song, Hallelujah, is played, and the two of them are
sex scene. Yeah, yeah. It's just like,
doesn't work. But the only one that really worked for me in that was the Bob Dylan song at the start. You know,
the credits. Yeah, yeah. It's brilliant.
Know. Yeah, but I think, again, there were songs that were trying to forced in, and someone thought, this will really go with the feel of the movie, and didn't work there. But this is 10 times worse. But anyway, look, they end up having to escape this place, and after fucking killing all the bad guys, they escape via boat by jumping out a window, or jumping out off the roof, I think, actually, sorry.
Yeah.
And they land down and escape in a little speedboat. And so while they're kind of in their next little hideout, she overhears Sam Rockwell making a call saying that he's sick of her. She deserves
with the door open. He makes the call.
Yeah, with
the
door
bathroom,
open.
He's with the door fully
he's
open.
A spy. Yeah, he's a spy. This one, and he's in the next room saying, "You know, she fucking deserves a bullet in the head. She doesn't suspect
it." Really loud.
It's like she's in the next room. Like,
she can 100%
hear you. Even if the door was closed, she could probably hear you. You know what I mean? So it's just bizarre. So she can actually hear. She's freaked out. Like, obviously, I don't want a fucking bullet in the head. So she grabs the, doesn't know who he's, we don't see who he's talking to, we just see the back of the person's head on the other end of the line. So she grabs the hacker's logbook and she goes, right, I'm out of here. She then calls her mom and dad, right? So she calls her mom and says, there's in America somewhere, right? I'm not sure, California, remember?
Yeah.
And says, somewhere. There's all this mad shit coming on. And she's like, hang on a second, we're going to come to you. So she calls and says, we're going to come to visit you. So she calls, the mum calls dad, says, books and plane tickets, we're going to London. Fucking, it's like 5 minutes later, they're in London. She's wandering the streets of London, going like, where the fuck am I? What the fuck am I going to do? This guy's a lunatic, da da da. And next thing you know, she's in this fucking hotel room, and the parents just fucking show up. It's like, fucking second, how did they get to London? Like, it's just straight away, they're just there. Now, obviously, we find out why later on, but at the time, fucking managed to make it there in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, obviously, the man walks in first, and the next thing we see, Brian, the dad walks in, and it's Brian Cranston. So, straight away, you're kind of...
Dun, dun, dun. Hang on. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're kind of going, hang on a fucking second, because at the start, again, you're trying to, at this point, you're trying to figure out what the hell is going on, because if Brian Cranston wanted her dead, and he's her dad all along, we're like, well, surely if he's her dad, he could have killed her fucking multiple times, or could have got her multiple times. Why is he having... sending loads of these guys together if at the whole time he's her dad, he could just call her up and go, here, sweetheart, come and meet me here. Like, surely that would mean, why did you need to send 1,000 guys on the train in this building all to go and capture her when you could just go pick the phone up and go, here, love,
I'll
meet you downstairs, meet you somewhere for a coffee. And she'd have, wouldn't expect, suspect anything at all. You know, so it's a weird, weird choice. Anyway, we're left wondering what the hell is going on there. Sam Rockwell ends up fucking breaking into the hotel, and he pulls a gun on the fucking parents, and that's when the parents kind of break character and they start saying, you'll never get out of here, da-da, and they pull guns as well. And so, like, what the fuck is going on? Sam Rockwell ends up shooting the mum, and he escapes with Bryce Dallas Howard. And again, like, she's a little bit traumatized that her ma has just been shot. That traumatized, like,
it's over, she knows quite, the ma's quite dead. Quickly, quite quickly, yeah.
As far as we know, the ma's dead. As far as now, we don't have a fucking clue what's going on. She's after being shot. We're still figuring what the fuck is going on. Because we haven't hit the halfway point of the movie yet, so we're still going, like, what the fuck is going on? And now she starts. What's weird is she starts seeing, and this is another jarring part, Daz. I'm not sure if you'd agree with me, but at the start she was seeing Sam Rockwell as Henry Cavill. So we're starting to think, okay, what is it?
Yeah.
Is it that she's been writing about this guy the whole time? Mm. Is that what it is? Now it changes that now she's seeing herself as Henry Cavill. She's seen reflection, and when she sees the reflection, she keeps just talking herself. To it.
It's just like, what the fuck is going
on? And she's talking to herself. I say, why are you saying, I thought, why, you know, and he's told you that she's been writing about him and that, that. I am saying, what the fuck are we seeing it? And,
I thought that was like... Is that some kind of like the filmmakers thinking they're very clever, kind of going, oh, now she's seeing herself as this Henry Cavill, that, like, is she subconsciously realizing that maybe she's something else, or is she Argyle, or this kind of stuff? And you're kind of going, but there's nothing in the actual story to lend us to believe that's happening in her mind. Her parents just been fucking killed, like, or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, like, we'll get
it just doesn't make any sense.
But that's the direction it's going. But on the information we have to this point, all we know is that she keeps seeing him as Argyle. Mm. And at the same time, he has told her that the shit that's happened in the book to Argyle has actually happened to him. You know, so we're already kind of, well, hang on a fucking second then. If why is she seeing herself? It's not, obviously it gets explained later on. But at this point, it's infuriating that we're not, there's nothing that would lead us to believe that, oh, that's why you made that choice to make him see him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Himself, him as Cavill, and now see you. So it didn't, I thought that was just silly. But they end up going to Sam Jackson, who turns out he was the guy who was on the phone later. And Sam Jackson is in this place in France. And it turns out his name is Alfie, just like the
cat
that she has. And this is where the movie completely kind of turns on its head. So this is the first big twist where something is kind of explained to us. So we find out the reason she's being seen herself in the reflections is that she's actually Argyle, as Taz just said. She's an agent called Rachel Kyle, or Kyle. And so Ellie Conway, the writer, isn't her real name. She's actually Rachel Kyle. So Rockwell explains that she went on a mission. They didn't know what happened to her, but she ended up in this coma, and the division found her memory was gone. And so the division ended up planting themselves, Catherine O'Hara and Brian Cranston, as her parents, and gave her this whole brainwashed thing, you know, and just brainwashed fucking history and all the rest of it. False history about herself.
Yeah.
And so she ends up, they give her like a notebook of all her notes. And so she ends up writing books, which end up being a real account of her real life. And it's just, it's unnecessarily convoluted.
It really is. You're just going, what is the fucking point of this? And the fact that they're just going, and now, like, they're, you know, they're coming after her because her books are too real or whatever, giving away fucking secrets. I mean, you're kind of going, but this is 5 years ago. Like, she's on her fifth book or something, which not when the first book comes out, and it's pretty close to the bone in terms of like their organization or giving away secrets or whatever is the point of it. You think they come after her then? Just like, you know, she's a writer. She's probably pretty easy to find and shut up or whatever. It's just, it's, yeah, it's too convoluted. And it's, I don't know if it's pointless, but it's just like, you're kind of going, why? Why is this so much fucking, you're like, you need to juggle four balls here. Why do you have 10 in your hand? What's going on here? You know?
Yeah. And the brainwashing, like, doesn't make any sense. Like, it's supposed to be this super, like, MK Ultra fucking brainwashing stuff. But, like, it doesn't, as you said, this is 5 years that she's been then writing books. And then I mentioned, does she not have one friend in the whole world? And she kind of comes into it and go, well, do I have a Facebook account? Where are my friends? Well, actually, no, yeah, don't know anybody. Because that's what would have happened. She's not, because otherwise, if she had it been found, someone that actually knew her, they would have gone, your name isn't fucking Ellie Conway. Your name is fucking Rachel Kyle. So she must have been isolated from him. So does she not ask any questions to end her parents about her amnesia? Do I not
it's
know?
It's such a high-profile job to have
as
somebody who's been brainwashed and is living a life that's a few years old. It's just like, surely you're not a take a shit. Like, come on.
Yeah, it makes fucking zero fucking sense. Like, it doesn't make any fucking sense. She doesn't say anything like, oh, I don't have any memory from X amount or that.
On to the next plot point. Let's go. They just keep moving and moving.
It was eye-rolling fucking stuff. but like, she has, as I said, she ends up making books and it turns out they're like a real life account of her life and her missions with Sam Rockwell and all the rest of it. So while they're having this fucking old yap about it, Sam Jackson, he cracks the code of the logbook and turns out they need to meet this character called the Secret Keeper of Secrets. And so this is Sophia Boutella, who was also in the Kingsman movie.
Yeah.
Rebel Moon. And so she'd only meet with Rachel Kyle. She won't meet with anybody else because she's the keeper of secrets and she's very serious about the secrets that she keeps, which is mentioned to us multiple times throughout. So
She has a line when Bryce Dallas Howard asked to use her computer or something, or she says you can use your computer. She says, how do I know it's secure? She says something like, there's a reason I'm the keeper of secrets. Do you know why? I can keep them. You're like, oh wow, that's okay. That's actually a line. Fucking hell, who writes this? Fucking drivel. It's
That solves that then. That's grand. but they end up going. They have to go. They say, look, you're gonna have to do it. She's like, well, I don't have all my fucking memories back yet. And look, you'll be able to do it. The two of us will go. He goes, look, we were actually a couple before this. You know, we were in love and da 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 da. Let's go off and meet this secret keeper. So they go off to some sort of desert palace. Again, they don't show how they get there. They just fucking show up to this desert fucking palace place to meet her. And she has the master key. So again, there's this awkward thing where she has to pretend that she knows who she is. You know, she's kind of like, oh, I don't have to deal with your bullshit. And it's her being all awkward and everything. She doesn't quite get it. But while she's looking at the file on the computer, she gets this shocked look because she sees the names of the file of the people who were actually involved in the division. And so sure enough, you know, it's Brian Cranston and da da da, but she sees a picture and we're like, okay, you know, I wonder who that is. Why has she got this shocked look? Is it Samuel L. Jackson? Is it going to be fucking Sam Rockwell? Mm. Who is she seeing? You know? And then it turns out Catherine O'Hara, the Ma, wasn't dead. She turns up and says, oh, I had a bulletproof vest on the whole time.
Yeah.
And then she starts telling her now she needs to follow her real memories. So this is the one who had brainwashed her the whole time. Now tells her, don't mind those fake ones. Now I need now to be, first of all, don't remember the real stuff. Now remember all this fake stuff. Now remember all the real stuff. And it's just so fucking stupid. So she starts having fucking flashbacks. It turns out that she's the one that had killed the hacker, Bryce Dallas Howard. Rachel was the one that killed the memory, killed him. But the hacker had got the place fucking triggered, rigged with explosives. And so she had to fucking jump out the window as it exploded. And she fell into a river and she woke up with amnesia. And that's how the division ended up getting her. And it's just like, for fuck's sake, would you stop with these fucking twists? Like, you've already had the twist that she's not who she thinks she is. And then there's a twist, okay, well, actually she's a spy all along. And now not only she's a spy, but she's actually working for the guys.
And we haven't fully got a grip on any of the twists before pull the rug out again. You're just like, hold on, what's happening here? And they kind of go, okay, so she, no, it's next one. And they're like, okay, so is she? And they're like, no, something else. And it's they talk about losing interest. You just have no idea what the fuck is going on. And you don't care because they don't give you enough time to get invested in anything. It's just like, look how smart we are and look how quick we're making this movie fly past you. Fucking hell.
And as you said, it's there's no time. It's just after you've just found this stuff out at his little place in France. We've just found out that she's actually Rachel Kyle and that she's actually one of the good guys, that she's after getting caught by the bad guys and they've been fucked with her head. That's what we've just found it out. The very next scene is with the secret keeper and the Catherine O'Hara turns up. We find out, actually, no, she was actually the one who killed the hacker and she's working for the division instead. A second, we only just found it. Like you said, let us sit with it for a while. Let us now start to believe that she's Rachel Kyle. We've no time to sit with that because now she's not Rachel Kyle, the good guy. She's Rachel Kyle, the bad guy. And supposedly Sam Rockwell wouldn't have had any idea. Let us sit with it for a few minutes, but they don't. But then Sam Rockwell is being fucking tortured to get the location. And he tells her, like, again, we've only just found out that she's been working for the division. While Sam Rockwell is getting tortured, and he says, yeah, you were working for them, but you were playing both sides and you wanted out. It's like, hang on a fucking second, then who does she work for? Like, she's good guys. And it's literally the very next scene. So it's jumping from set piece to set piece, and there's things
have happened. Scene to scene, sides. Like,
she's with the good guys. She's just arrived, now she's with the good guys, now she's with the bad guys, now she's back to the fucking movie. She was playing both of them. It's just... Like,
Be surprised that it would be perfect in keeping with the character if she just turned around and said to Sam, what the fuck? Who do I work for? Who am I? And turned to the audience and go, do you fucking know? Because I don't fucking know.
And that scene, I was expecting her to kind of, okay, she's going to have some flash and she's going to go, fuck, I just remembered everything and then kill all the bad guys in the room. No. Brian Cranston says, no, you're a division through and through. He's talking out of his arse. And so she shoots Sam Rockwell in the heart. Shoots Sam Rockwell and says that she knows how to find Samuel L. Jackson. Right, so that's where we kind of get left off.
And I couldn't wait for how he was, like, because you're kind of going, she couldn't have killed him. So I couldn't wait for how that's going to be resolved. Gonna how are they going to explain this?
How are they going to explain this thing away? Shocker, Sam Rockwell isn't dead. So Sam Rockwell is in the fucking room. He gets his fucking, he's in the handcuffs to the chair, but these guards come in. He ends up fucking coming in and kills all the guards. So all the rest of them are off. The main characters are off searching for Sam Jackson. Rockwell isn't dead. He kills the guards, and you're still like, he's up and he's jumping, he's moving around. And the fuck is he doing this? He shoots himself up full of adrenaline. He gets all this adrenaline into his legs, into his arms. He's like multiple shots, and he's fucking. Like fucking Popeye with his spinach, he's fucking ready to go. He's going out to kick some ass. So then, this has only just happened, and then it turns out she does remember everything, and now she double crosses again. So now she double crosses the division after just double crossing Sam Rockwell. She double crosses the division, and she knocks out Sam Rockwell, and she heads down to the armory. And at the same time, so does Sam Rockwell. And this is where we get our dumbass explanation of how he's alive.
It's so astonishing.
She mentioned that a fan had sent it to her in an email because the character of Kira, we mentioned at the very, very start of this section, we mentioned Kira was in the book was this person who got shot and someone wanted the character to come back and sent her an email saying, you know what, if you shoot someone like 1 inch to this fucking part of the heart, you shoot right through, it goes through and through, it goes one through one part of the heart, comes out the other, but once the hole is plugged, the person's fine.
That's
how you can bring this character back. So she remembered that in that fucking second, it was in her head, so she took the gun out, handguns from across the room, and managed to get this perfect shot through his heart.
Sam Rockwell even addresses this in the fucking script. Like, he goes... he said, okay, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. You said you purposefully shot me through an inch hole space in my heart after not firing your gun for over 5 years based on an idea that a fan sent into you. And he just says, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And it's at the same moment, I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever fucking seen in the movie. It's like, and it's played just totally straight, just like, Okay, that's okay. Yeah, let's just run with that then, will we? Fucking hell.
Fucking ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous explanation as to why he's still alive. You have the little cut of her going back and she's plugged up the hole in his heart and that's why he managed to survive. With like a tissue paper or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, the two of them have to fight their way. This is the fucking dumbest shit ever. This is a big action one of three big action scenes, I suppose, as we finish up the movie.
Set it up with the whirly dance though. When they first get to the Arabian fucking place or whatever, they have this dance apparently that they do.
So at the very start, when Henry Cavill is first dancing with Dua Lipa, he has this line: "Do you do the whirly bird?" Dance, basically, the scene in the trailer, fixed up. Your one's got her legs either side of his shoulders, and he spins her around. It's supposed to be sexy, just looks awkward as shit.
Yeah, he ends up facing crotch.
So when the two of them are, so when Bryce Dallas Howard and Sam Rockwell are kind of, he's telling her that they're coupled and da-da-da as they're having a drink in the sand palace place. She does that dance with him. Yeah. He lifts her up the same. She's wearing the same gold dress, the whole lot. Does a spin around.
And you know what's coming back at some point in the movie. Exactly, you know what's coming back.
But here they have to get past these guards, right? So there's the guards coming to the armory. They're locked in the armory. Of course, the armory is full of fucking machine guns, handguns, grenades, gas grenades, the whole fucking shit, like the Matrix fucking amount of guns. So like, right, they have to fight their way out of this room and kill everybody. And the whole scene is just the cringiest, dumbest fucking thing. So the music choice, first of all, is Leona Lewis. I'm pretty sure it's Leona Lewis cover of a Snow Patrol song. That fucking...
Didn't even play the original song. So, Run. Yeah.
So they're playing that and basically the whole scene is in slow motion over this song. But they've rolled out these tear gas canisters because they've got their own... They've both got gas masks on. They roll tear gas out. For some reason... The tear gas look is all pink and purple multicolored, and blue. It's multicolored gas that comes out of these tear gas things. So this fight's going on, surrounded by just really thick fucking gas. And supposed to make it look really cool. But as they're doing it and they're fighting, yes, he does that thing where he picks her up and he spins around. They're basically dancing in slow motion to this fucking song while they're killing people.
There's
hearts are being made out of the fucking, out of the gas as they're dancing and stuff like that. It's just... It's so fucking lame. Like, it's just, it was painful. I was watching it the whole time. Make it end.
It goes on for a long time as well.
It does, and it keeps, you keep getting fucking point of view camera shots, you know, of her faces on the mast and Sam Rock as they look at each other smiling as they spin around killing people. And it's supposed to be this mixture of, okay, it's all this death, but their love is in the middle of it.
They could have been murdered at any point during this. Like,
and they're just fucking spinning around like fucking Muppets. Like, it's absolutely. I honestly think the music is terrible. Yeah. It was a woeful scene. Absolutely.
It looks so, so bad. You can see in somebody's eyes, or like if somebody's telling you about it, or somebody did a storyboard on it, you probably go, "Oh, this would be fucking cool." And then if someone says, "What song are you going to pick?" you'd go, Run by, or I was going to say Paw Patrol, by Snow Patrol. Paw Patrol fucking song would be even better. Snow Patrol. And said, but no, we're not going to even use the original. Because maybe the original may have worked. It's a fucking good song. But like, we're going to get the Leona Lewis. Like, why they chose the cover,
makes it even slower than the song already is.
My God. You could ask Spotify to choose any fucking song. And 99% of songs will be better than this choice. It's an epic fail of preposterous levels. It's just like, this should not, if this scene doesn't work, you kind of go, all right, it doesn't work. But as you're saying, it was just cringe. It's just like, I felt like I was in a cinema, you know, hand over my eyes going, oh my God, I can't believe this is actually happening. Like, this is really embarrassing.
It's embarrassing for everybody involved. And the problem is that we go from there straight into another fucking dumbass action scene. So, we go there and it's like this whole thing is taking place. They're on an oil fucking tanker or whatever the fuck they're on. They're on a big ass fucking ship. And so they're going down, they're trying to escape and they're still being chased. When they go down, the bad guys come in, she starts fucking shooting and all the bullet holes they're putting in is making all this fucking black crude oil is just spilling out all over the floor. So this engine room or whatever they're in, the floor is just becoming black with fuel and someone says, "We can't fucking shoot guns in here. It'll light the whole place up. So everybody put your guns down. We can't have it." It's like, right.
Yeah.
What the fuck are they going to do to get out of here? You know, obviously it's going to be something lame. The whole floor is covered in oil. And The way they do it is,
I can't believe you're actually going to say this.
They get in there, she gets two knives and she fucking stamps on them on her boots and turns them basically into ice skates, because it's mentioned earlier on in the movie that she was a great ice skater as a kid, and that's a real thing. So she turns the fucking, she turns Sam Rockwell and says something on the lines of, all that stuff about being an ice skater, I was a great ice skater, right? And he's like, yeah. She goes, great. So she gets these things and then she pulls, she gets another fucking machine gun and she gets a knife to the top of it. So she goes and it's her skating around in oil while she takes guys down, stabbing them with the knife on the top of this fucking machine gun. And it's just, again, it's a terrible fucking tune that they add to it. And it's supposed to look really cool, but it's just laugh out loud stupid. Like, it's just, she's doing fucking spinning around. Like, why would this work? Why would it work? Why could she just stamp on knives and it went to her boots and now she can skate on oil the same way she would on ice? Like, it makes no sense. And she's spinning and she's ducking down and she's taking him out, right? And then, after going through all that fucking nonsense, the bad guys are going to start ganging up on her. She fucking reaches down, takes a machine gun and shoots them all anyway. She does this fucking spin around thing and just unloads fucking bullets all over all of them. What was the whole point of the whole thing with the fucking skates then? Why didn't you just shoot them all to begin with? Like, it just... What was the point of the whole scene you just showed us?
Because it's going to look so cool. Somebody said it's going to look so fucking cool, man. It's going to be rad. It doesn't make sense. But it's going to be so cool. People, we're going to win awards for this fucking scene, man. People are going to lose their shit.
Do you know who did it better? Jason Statham in Transporter. He takes a load of fucking grease, oil still in the ground, and he stamps on the two pedals off the bike, and they stick to his feet, and that helps him.
It makes sense.
So he's kicking dude's ass. He's able to move in the grease because he's wearing traction. He's got metal things, grips on his fucking, or pedals off the bike, and he ends up battering. And they're slipping all over the place, and he beats the shit out of them. Shout out to Jason Statham. But this, I don't know if this is where they got the idea for it, but absolutely shocking.
It's just silly. It's just silly and stupid in all the wrong ways, pretty much.
Yeah. I think they end up getting to the bridge or something next, isn't it, Daz? It's when Bryan Cranston's there, and it's, for some reason, they decide this cat who was kind of being this cat has been docile the entire movie. He's done nothing but sit in a fucking backpack. You know what I mean? He's done nothing. He's just this thing. Sam Rockwell hates cats. He's allergic to them. Even when he holds the cat and drops it off a roof, it doesn't get hurt. It doesn't do anything. It's the most docile thing. But for some reason, the cat just fucking goes bananas, becomes murderous, and dives at fucking Bryan Cranston and Sam Rockwell.
And scratches his eyes. But for some reason, they need his retina scan to send some fucking file. And it's like, the cat just rips his fucking eyes. It's just
They walk in. They walk into this big room.
The plot needs to happen.
They need to upload this file and send it to Sam Rockwell. But when they get in, he walks in behind and goes, well, you won't be able to do it because you need my eyeballs to do it. And I'm not fucking doing it. I've got a shotgun pointed at
him. Yeah.
And that's when the cat ends up fucking jumping at him. Sam Rockwell kills him. Like, oh, God, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to be able to send it to him? Well, turns out we can actually do it directly from this big fucking place up on the mast or whatever the fucking name of the part of the ship is called. The fucking dish or whatever the fuck it is up on the ship. We can go up and do it.
Yeah.
So they're in the middle of sending the file. And then we get another twist. So it turns out that while...
twist number 465.
While she was in hospital, all the shit that Catherine O'Hara was doing to her, she had done a, like, fucking teacup-style thing from Get Out, you know, when she's twisting
the
teacup
and
control it. She's doing something like that.
Mind control now.
Box. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's got the music box. She does the music box and tells her, kill Sam Rockwell. So again, there's another fucking shite music, mismatch music choice, and the two of them have a fight. We know that it's not going to fucking happen. As long as the music box is going off, she's going to keep on battering him. So she's fucking fighting him, and she's about to kill him. And all of a sudden, someone pops up from behind Catherine O'Hara, smacks her with a wrench. The music box falls and smashes, and so she snaps out of it. And we're like, oh, fucking okay. Who was it that was in? And it turns out it was the partner for the very start of the movie, was still alive. She's the one who had sent the email about the heart shot earlier.
She was the fan. It's like
she was the fan.
The most
sent the email
underwhelming reveal.
Yeah.
The most underwhelming reveal known to man. Like, just it was, I even forgot that character existed.
It was absolutely ridiculous. Like, and how did she know that this was even going to come up? Yeah. Did she send her the email that this would be a cool way to do it? But how did she know that at some point she might need to shoot someone through the heart to bring them back to life?
Yeah. And like,
you know what I mean?
But the problem with that final fight sequence, it's a pretty shit fucking sequence anyway, but it's epitomized by it's the Beatles, isn't it? Now and Then, their last Beatles song is the one that's playing.
Yeah.
And this, and you know, basically knew more about that song being in the movie, coming up to the movie, than the actual movie. It was just like, oh, Matthew Vaughn's after getting access to this last fucking song, and blah, blah, blah. And it just plays out. And again, it's, yeah, that's a great coup, and you got a cool fucking song for your soundtrack for the album. But again, it just doesn't work. It's the wrong fucking song. It's just like, just play a fucking a score over a fight sequence. Do something. Yeah, it's fucking stupid.
Yeah, I have to be clear. When I say like terrible music choice, I don't mean terrible choices, not terrible music. The most of the music in the movie is fine to good.
Yeah.
It's just not meant for this fucking movie, or at least not meant for the scenes that they put
at
in.
All.
Like, as I said, I'm a disco fan. I like a lot of the tunes that they use. I have no problem. They're just not with the scenes. But
it turns scenes into truly awful scenes, compounded by the fact that the music is playing over it. Yeah.
So anyway, they end up finishing sending off the fucking file off the thing. They escape off the boat, but for some reason she goes back to being Ellie Conway, because they go back to her as Ellie Conway. I assume it's going to be her cover now, and she's writing. She's released the final book, and so it's another one of these book signings. She's released the final book, which is basically telling the story of the movie that we just fucking saw. About the division finally being shut down and Argyle finally being able to go and retire. And then the stinger then is that, because that's the credit role. And then the stinger is, we cut back to it again and back to the book signing, and this guy at the back stands up to talk, and it's Henry Cavill, but he's got a mullet, and she says something like, have anybody got any questions? And it's Henry Cavill, and he's got a mullet, and he's talking in like an accent from like the southern states of America. And he says, yeah, I might have a thing or two to ask, or a few questions to ask. And that's it. And it cuts then back out to the rest of the credits. And you're like, what? Who is he? What's the point? What the fuck is the point of that? Who is he? Why does he look? Why does she look shocked? Is there going to be a fucking another movie where we explain where he comes from? Like, it was a weird stinger to have at the end. Because it was already wrapped, like, okay, it's not a good movie, but at least it finished on a thing where you can go, okay, Ellie Conway is her cover. She's going to, you know, get away from the spy life or whatever it is. That's fine.
They're tied up, They're setting up another movie in this universe, and it's like, oh, we don't want one. We just don't want one, and that makes no fucking sense.
They gave him $200 million, and this movie stank the shit out of it. So they're not getting a fucking sequel. So it was just annoying. It was an annoying stinger to have in the credits.
It was such a bum note to finish on, even more so, which just confused me even more, just as to why this movie was happening, really, to be honest. I'm sure Matthew Vaughn has grand ideas for this universe to tie in with the Kingsman people, and it's run out of steam. It's already run out of steam. Like, you're not getting more money to make another movie like this. I don't know the figures, but I'm pretty sure it tanked the box office. So
yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I think, like, stay away from plot twists from now on, Matthew Vaughn. Just stay away from them,
or just keep it to one. You know,
or like either it's him or Jason Fuchs who wrote it. Like, whatever one, just keep it to it. Keep it to like two max. But it was annoying. Like, I'm just glad it's over, to be honest. Like, it was
2 hours 20 as well. That's why it's
2 hours 20, and I watched it in one go.
Yeah.
It was a difficult movie to watch, because it was just, it's not, when I say convoluted or say complicated, I don't mean complicated as in it's hard to follow. I mean, it's complicated as in it's unnecessarily complicated. There's no need for you to make these choices, to make these switches. It's easy to follow, but it just makes you angry that the choices that they've made. Double cross, triple cross, fucking, you know, another twist. Like, just fucking stop trying to be clever, because it's coming off as the absolute opposite of that.
Yeah. How's that working out for you? B? being clever.
Yeah. So look, anyway.
Yeah, because I had an impressive cast. You know what I mean? I think
cast is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, the idea of like a female-led protagonist in this kind of spy world and stuff is, you know, could have the makings of a great action comedy. But yeah, as you said, a convoluted mess. I don't think it was particularly funny. For an action romp, it was slow paced, way too long, 2 hours 20 minutes. That's fucking crazy.
It's just borrowed stuff from elsewhere.
It's borrowing from better movies.
The first thing I thought when I saw her, and Samuel L. Jackson's also in this movie, the first thing I thought when she dyes her hair blonde and she's wearing the black eyeshadow was A Long Kiss Goodnight. You know, she lost her memory. She's a fucking super 100%. Spy. Samuel L. Jackson was also in that movie. It's just, you've just taken big parts from that movie. Like, there's nothing new here. There's nothing really worth your time to watch it. Like, I assume it's on Amazon Prime or something now. I wouldn't even bother with it. It's even if you're into like kind of spy thing, there's not enough fun in it even to kind of make it worth a watch. It is a dud. It comes down from me. I'd give it two out of five.
Two out of five, and that would be just for the cast. Just for Sam Rockwell, you get a star for having Sam in your movie.
He's fucking great. He's charismatic as fuck, you know what I mean? So, and it's got a great cast. I mean, Catherine O'Hara, Bryan Cranston, Samuel L. Jackson, these are all great. I love Bryce Dallas Howard as well. These are all just wasted in this movie. But look, let's just move on. I know this was an extra long episode because we wanted to talk about the Oscars and everything else. Yep. This is a long one. So I'll shut up talking about this. So Daz can bring us on into the retro corner. So take it away there, Daz.
Happy days. Thanks, Phil, for that. Another beauty that you don't have to watch. You can just listen to us bash it. So now for the retro corner. Myself and Phil always look for games or movies that tie in with either the content of an episode or an anniversary of such. And it turns out that Super Metroid, the game this week in the Retro Corner, turns 30 years old in a few days, which is fucking, it's wild. And it's a very easy one to chat about. Briefly just go over it. It was released for the SNES in 1994. It was the third entry in the franchise after the 1986 NES Classic. And the Game Boy Metroid 2 came out in 1991, on the Game Boy. And Super Metroid is listed as a side-scrolling action-adventure, but fuck me, does that description rob this game of its colossal impact in video game history, essentially. The original game in 1986 is actually a dear one to me because it's one of my first gaming memories, one of a few like that in Mario, and kind of my first foray into the escapism of video games. And the sequel, I remember when it was released on the Game Boy, was not so much of a letdown because it's a great game, but it was the fact that it was released on the Game Boy, you know, in little handheld black and white. It was just like, what the fuck, you know? We just wanted it released on the NES. I just remember that being slightly perturbed by that. But then Super Metroid arrives in 1994 on the SNES in glorious 16-bit color, and what a fucking game. We jump into the boots of Samus Aran once again, female bounty hunter, and she was on a mission to a desolate planet, ZB's, to retrieve an infant Metroid creature stolen by the space pirate leader Ripley, blah blah blah. But I hadn't played this in fucking ages, and I played a little bit of it last night. And from the slow, like, it's the pre-credit sequence, pre-credit intro with the eerie music and the like, kind of cries of a captured Metroid in the background, we are told that the last Metroid is in captivity and the world is at peace, la la la. But this ominous opening is the perfect setup for what is to come. The game begins on Space Colony Series, and it's a traditional side-scrolling gameplay. But once you flee the station to avoid explosion and follow the space pirate back to ZB's, that's when the game opens up. And that's where like the feeling of isolation in these games is just so meticulously crafted. The sense of dread, the atmosphere is astonishing. And it was only after watching or playing it again last night, things that I kind of missed, like on the opening credit title sequence, there's like dead scientists on the ground. You know, before I never really knew what the hell they were, you know, and for a Nintendo game,
back then. Yeah, it's pretty grim, you know. But Super Metroid is obviously, it's known for its excellent combat, its exploration, storytelling, its fantastic game design, the graphics, music. For me, it's absolutely quite like a masterpiece, and it's widely regarded as one of the greatest and most important video games of all time. And I think rightly so. Like, it's a significant entry in gaming history for many, many reasons. But mainly, I think it showed the video games could be so much more, especially coming onto the SNES, Nintendo with its kind of three-pronged attack of like Mario, Zelda, and Metroid. Those games are really kind of coming into their own with stellar entries with Zelda, like A Link to the Past, Super Mario World, and especially with Super Metroid. They essentially created, for me, like, it's the perfect game, pretty much. And when it was released back in 94, like, I was 15, I was completely absorbed by the game, playing it for months, what seemed like months. And it is a tough game. When I went back playing, I only played for about an hour last night, but you can see online, people, I hate when you look back at these things, you see people completing it, and a full walkthrough was like 4 hours, and it's like, I was playing that for 6 fucking months, man, what the fuck. Yeah, what are your memories of this?
I love this game because I remember, as you said, the big ones for Nintendo were Zelda and were Mario. Mario, very much a platformer, and Zelda, you had that, you know, you had the RPG element, but it was all you had to collect, get a key or get a new thing to open certain parts and stuff. And so it had the RPG, whereas this had that, it wasn't just raw action, it was loads of action games. So Metroid had the action, you were constantly fighting, whether it was Metroids or whatever other creatures, space pirates and Chozos or whatever else you were attacking. But it added in that you needed power-ups to get into other levels, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, added
that stuff into it. And so it made it way more interesting when action the game. It wasn't just a fucking run along, kill everything in this level, get to the next level. You had to figure out to get to certain parts, you know. We know Castlevania did something similar. That's why everybody calls them Metroidvania-style games. You know, this levels that you're in, places that will become unlockable once you progress a bit further, you'll get certain devices and stuff. And it was just... It made a much more deep experience from an action game than I had previously played. Like, I at the right young age of whatever I was, fucking 12, playing it, the games that I had played were heavy on action, but, you know, that's what it was. It was always just blowing shit up. It was just that element of exploration and action together just completely drew me in. And it's something that's obviously throughout the series. But it just, it's just a fucking cool game. The music is really class. It's a cracking little game.
Yeah, and that's like, you're just touching it there. The whole Metroidvania term or the subgenre was essentially created because of this game. Down to that kind of quasi open world aspect where, you know, it's not your normal side scrolling shoot 'em up. You know, you'd explore the world and you get stuck and you go, why can't I fucking get up there? And then, you know, you get the reward of a new traversal or a new weapon that you go, hold on, maybe I can double jump now or whatever, and I can get past this part.
Yeah.
And that feeling of being lost and navigating to the next section and getting a new game mechanic or whatever, a new traversal, was just so rewarding. You know, it's like, and that's a pillar of 2D Metroidvania action adventure games to this day, even up to Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, like recently. That's exactly, that game exists because of Super Metroid, essentially, and of Castlevania. But and playing it last night as well, the things that came to mind were its environmental storytelling, you know, without any dialogue or narration or anything, is just remarkable. Like, the lack of tutorials, and our pet peeve of, you know, handholding of today's games is just non-existent. It's just like they just plop you down and in this world and just go, right, off you go. And like, you learn traversal, you learn combat from trial and error, but there's even, like, I remember a point where you learn how to wall jump by just following these little bugs, and you can't get past a point, but when you see these little bugs go in front of you and they just do the wall jump, and you're looking at them going, hold on a second, and you try and do it and you're like, fucking hell, like a fucking, it's not like, come over here, press A and do this, you know. It gives you credit as a gamer, your intelligence. And the world was so creepy and felt so isolated. And I think the whole series from the first one, and especially the initial three, were kind of modeled on Alien and the whole aesthetic or creepiness or atmospheric. The atmosphere was kind of so prevalent in Super Metroid, but it was definitely taken from the Alien series, kind of broken computer screens, dead scientists, and this kind of eerie kind of bits and bobs. But I'll just touch on the lore of the first of the lore and the story of the first three games is fucking beautiful. Like, I mean, you're tasked with hunting and killing these Metroid creatures, but like in the second game, if you remember, you come across the last, you've killed all the Metroids, but you come across this little larva thing that opens up and it's like a small baby Metroid and acts kind of like a child and kind of follows you and kind of becomes your friend and you learn to kind of care for it or whatever. And then towards the end of the third game, you know, spoiler alert for whoever hasn't played this in 30 years, but that Metroid from the second game, that kind of child like friend, is grown into a larger Metroid. And in the final boss, when you're about to die, you're on your knees and it comes in and sacrifices itself to save you and kills itself. That's like fucking mind blowing Shakespearean shit back in the 90s. You know what I mean? It broke my heart when I was 15. It was just fucking beautiful. It's just so lovely to see something taken from the second game and pay off in the third game. And I think beauty comes to mind so much with this game. Like, the graphics at the time were incredible. The art design still is on another level and has been all the way through the Metroid series up to Metroid Dread recently. But it's a beautiful, brilliant game. It's withstood the test of time incredibly. It's atmosphere, it's fluid gameplay, it's epic bosses, like some fucking still the toughest bosses ever. I got stuck in like second one last night. That's why I turned it off. I couldn't get past it. The graphics, genre-defining music at the time. It's an absolute classic and easily one of the greatest games of all time and one of the most important games of all time and still holds its own 30 years on. So if you haven't played it, get out and play it. You need to, if you have a Switch, you can get it on Nintendo Online or get one of those little mini SNES SNES things. I think that's the only way to play it. Yeah, if you can get one. I have one here somewhere in the attic that it's lost somewhere. Absolutely. Pick it up if you can. So, this has been a long enough episode. So we will leave it there for episode 22, I believe we're on. Just thanks to everyone for the feedback and support and social media and for playing and liking the podcast. If you have any comments or feedback or on our ramblings, please get in touch on middleagedgeeks@yahoo.com. Keep liking and listening and sharing. Any final thoughts on all the shite we've been going on about, Phil?
No, that's great. That was a great trip down memory lane for the Retro Corner. Well done, Daz. I do have Nintendo Online and I haven't played the game in many years. So I think I might give that a go in between bouts of Final Fantasy. But no, that's great. I just echoed what you're saying. Just keep on liking, subscribing and sharing and telling your mates, all that kind of stuff. It really helps us out.
Happy days. Okay, so from me, Daz, and from Phil, that's a wrap. And we'll catch you next week. Ciao, ciao.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.